Welcome to our first segment of this afternoon's program. It's Sunday, the 20th of February, 2022. It is now 1:02 p.m. in the studio. I'm your host, Kieran Murdoch. Many have been following the political developments surrounding MP Asset Michael closely. He has made it clear that he intends to contest the next general election, and it is clear that if his Antigua and Barbuda Labour Party manage to go forward with another candidate in that constituency, St. Peter, that Mr. Michael is prepared to run nonetheless, probably as an independent. Mr. Michael has, of course, been the target of numerous corruption allegations, which he has vehemently denied over the years in his long career in politics with the Antigua and Barbuda Labour Party. He has, in more recent years, been publicly accused of misbehavior by the sitting Prime Minister, Gaston Browne, of course, misbehavior which he has denied. And ostensibly, this has led to a fallout between the PM and Michael. In our discussion today, we are going to comment on Mr. Michael's contribution to the 2022 budget debate. He made his contributions on Thursday, which was just a few days ago. His comments raised a number of political issues, some surrounding him, some surrounding the government, and some surrounding the practice of politics in Antigua and Barbuda in general. We have, joining us for this segment, happy to have with us on this panel, Mr. Peter Wickham, director of the polling and research firm Caribbean Development Research Services. He's done numerous electoral polls in Antigua and Barbuda and elsewhere in the region, and is a commentator on Caribbean political and social affairs. Good afternoon to you, Mr. Peter Wickham.
Hi, good afternoon, Kevin.
We have joining us as well Dr. David Hines, a political commentator from Guyana. He's an associate professor of African and African American Studies at the Arizona State University. His focus is on Caribbean and African diaspora studies, and his research interests include governance and politics in the Caribbean, as well as black political leadership. Good afternoon to you, Dr. David Hines, and how are you doing? Still muted on Zoom there. Dr. Hines, if you are with us and if you have heard me, you'll have to unmute.
Good afternoon.
And we have finally joining us Mr. Akash Maharaj, an ambassador at large for the Global Organization of Parliamentarians Against Corruption, also known as GOPAC. It's an international non-governmental organization made up of parliamentarians from across the world, working together to combat corruption, strengthen good governance, and uphold the rule of law. Good afternoon to you, Mr. Maharaj. How are you doing?
Good afternoon. I'm well. Thank you for inviting me to join you.
Peter Wickham, I think that there were many persons that were looking at the budget debates for 2022, primarily because of what happened in the budget debates of 2021, which was a serious ventilation of grievances between the Prime Minister and Mr. Asset Michael during his presentation. Actually, in 2021, it rose to the level of crosstalk ongoing between him and the PM whilst he was actually on the floor during his debate. And it spawned a whole lot of discussions throughout the year, the comments, what came out there. So there were a lot of eyes focused on his presentation in Parliament this year. And he issued a rather stern rebuke of the government's analysis of its own performance. Specifically, he spoke about St. Peter. What did you make of that?
Morning and good to be here on the program. Asa Michael is walking a very fine line, and I think that he's engaging in political practice that is really not known to us in the Caribbean. I read the speech, and he set himself up as essentially a backbencher who felt that he had the right to be critical of the government, notwithstanding the fact that he wants to be a part of it. He continues to insist that he is a committed member of the Antigua Barbuda Labour Party. He even tried in the speech to set up this scenario where he suggested that the ABLP had good intentions for the constituency, but they have not fulfilled those intentions, especially since he is no longer a minister of the government. So he's essentially trying to ensure that he can still continue to present an ABLP philosophy, if that's entirely possible. But at the same time, he's being critical of what the government is doing, and more specifically, the Prime Minister. And it's an interesting strategy. I think it's one that is not likely to work. The Prime Minister has made it clear that he won't be the candidate. He seems to be insisting that he will. So I think he'll probably emerge as an independent ABLP, if there is such a thing, and suggest that he's going to operate in that way. But his speech was perhaps less stinging than last year in terms of the vitriol and so on. But it was clear in it that he's saying, you know, that he's trying to ingratiate himself to the constituents, while at the same time ensuring that the party that he is seeking to represent He is not abusing the party, but certainly he's trying to distance himself from the neglect of what he sees as a neglect of the government of the day. Having said that, though, I mean, we've heard it all before, you know, when you are no longer on board, everything is wrong. And I think most people are saying, you know, but why are all of these issues, which he's saying are going back several governments, why is it that these are only coming to the fore now? So that would be my initial perspective on his initiatives.
And Dr. David Hines, what do you make politically of the commentary? And this is in the context of an individual who is a center of national attention politically in the landscape of Antigua and Barbuda, and also when it comes to issues of ethics and integrity, because he's been the subject of a number of allegations which he has denied over the years. But a former member of government sort of taking the government to task on within the government party, but taking the government to task on its failings, according to him. But what did you make of the speech?
Well, I think it was a campaign speech rather than a budget speech. And he did take the present government to task, but he also took the UPP government to task. I think he's building a case, as we have observed in this program before, a case of victimhood. And he has broadened that case to include the UPP. So he is targeting the St. Peter's constituency, and he's saying, look, you have been neglected by both governments. You've been neglected by the party that you... that you voted for, and this neglect has to do with me. And it doesn't have to do with my incompetence, because I've served you well. I've gone into my own pockets and I have served you well. So the neglect has to do with me, because I have served you well. And I think he's building an effective case for an independent candidacy. One has to note that I think he has accepted that he will not be the candidate for the Labour Party, but he is making out the case of victimization and playing to that. Whether that would propel him to win the seat or not is yet to be seen. But I agree with Peter, that we have not seen anything like this in the Caribbean in recent times. I don't think at any time in our post-colonial politics.
Mr. Maharaja, one of the things that Mr. Michael stated up front in his speech, and I took a particular interest in a number of things he mentioned, because they actually spoke a bit to some of the issues, failings, flaws in how politics sort of functions in the country. But one of the first things he said, and I'm quoting from his presentation here, he said, quote, "We have a crisis of parliamentary representation in this country." And he spoke about the resources of the state that are needed to finance development across all constituencies equitably, being used by ruling party politicians to, as he put it, punish or reward according to the requirements of their political agenda to control the public will. Now, that's quite a stinging statement coming from an individual who sat in government for several years with the Gaston Brown administration and is now out of government. And we have had this tendency, not just in Antigua and Barbuda, but throughout the OECS, because of the smallness of the parliament and the number of seats, that cabinets tend to absorb the majority of the parliament's membership. Here you have Mr. Michael, who has been ousted from the cabinet, saying or acknowledging that, according to him, quote, "We have a crisis of parliamentary representation in the country." What do you make of that? Do you think that's something he would have been willing to acknowledge whilst he was in cabinet?
Obviously not. I think that his complaint about this crisis, this ethical and political crisis within the basic fabric of Antigua and Barbuda's political system, his complaints would carry a bit more moral weight if he had been opposed to them when he was running them, as opposed to being opposed to them now that he is on the out of this government. This speech is really remarkable. It struck me that in some ways, it's a kind of political murder-suicide speech, because on the one hand, he is exposing exposing actions by the government that, if they are true, are extraordinarily corrupt, and some of which arguably, not only some of which violate Antigua's own domestic laws, like the Representation of the People's Act. He is effectively saying that the government has been using public resources in an attempt to bribe voters in some constituencies, punish voters in another. That is clearly a crime, even under Antigua's laws. But it goes further than that. There are hints in his speech of what would amount to crimes against humanity. He has said in certain parts of his speech that the government has withheld public services from his constituency in an attempt to punish the people to force him out. And he has enumerated amongst those the withholding of medical services. If that's true, and if that's not just political hyperbole, he's accusing the government of Antigua and Barbuda of committing an international crime. You cannot, under international law, withhold public health services from part of a population in an attempt to bring about political change. But I mean, that it does go on and on, I suspect. But in addition to his accusations against the government, which are, as you say, stinging, he also inadvertently and apparently unknowingly confesses to all sorts of crimes on his own part, that he was a party to these actions and was apparently happy to be part of these actions because he's a loyal party man, as he put it, until his falling out with the prime minister, that he himself has been in a client-patron relationship. He goes so far as to say that no MP in Antigua and Barbuda's history has spent as much of his personal money on his constituency as he has. He clearly thinks that this is a compliment to himself. But what this is a confession of bribery on a historic scale of his own constituency. What I find remarkable about this isn't just, as you say, that he's saying there's a crisis of political representation. He is correct. As you point out, the fact that a majority of the legislators are in the executive branch of government means that the pyramid is inverted. What's supposed to happen is that a majority of the legislators are outside of the cabinet and are therefore able to impose parliamentary oversight on cabinet. Instead, with a majority of legislators being in cabinet, it amounts to the cabinet ministers policing themselves. And one should not be surprised to discover that in policing themselves, they find themselves innocent as the driven snow. But beyond that, it is a remarkable, even if one puts aside what he has said about the government, which I don't think one should, one can be certain that what he has said about himself must be true. And the fact that he is unaware that he is boasting to his country that he has violated all sorts of legal and ethical norms is extraordinary.
Mr. Peter Wickham, I wonder if I could bring you in to hone in on this issue specifically of the parliamentary representation, because that is not something that is regularly acknowledged by politicians in this country at all. The fact that we do have an anomaly where cabinet is generally the majority of parliament, and therefore that generally renders parliament incapable of really opposing the executive in any serious way. As I said, that is not something that political leadership or political parties in Antigua and Barbuda have really ever taken issue with. We see Mr. Michael publicly acknowledging this now in the forum of Parliament. Do you agree that crisis exists? And what do you make of his choosing to make that acknowledgement now?
Yeah, I mean, this existed almost to the beginning of time in vast majority of Caribbean islands. I think the only place where you don't find it would be Jamaica, Trinidad, and Tobago. But the parliament is too small in most of the OECS, even in Barbados. And once you have an imbalance in terms of the numbers elected, similar to what you have currently, there's no opportunity for a backbench. The Westminster system assumes that parliament will play a role in terms of scrutinizing the work of the executive. But the reality is that in no Caribbean island, save Jamaica and Trinidad and Tobago, are you in a situation where Parliament can do that? Because everyone who is a member of Parliament, invariably on the government side, is a minister. In the case of Barbados, there's no backbench for the opposition, but there's no backbench period because government won all the seats. In Antigua, it's really only two people who are not. Now, officially, you have a third backbench member, which would be Asset Michael. But frankly, there is no opportunity for scrutiny that is presented in that environment. And that's one of the deficiencies of our system. Your Public Accounts Committee in Antigua and Barbuda cannot work effectively simply because it requires an opposition leader that has some kind of strength to be able to deal with matters, a parliamentary strength, that is, to be able to deal with matters, to pull the committee together, to have it meet, to call witnesses and so on. And it just doesn't happen. So what Assemblyman Michael is saying is correct. But I am particularly intrigued by the suggestion that, amidst all of that, he also speaks to his own complicity in this whole thing. And he spends a mind-boggling amount of money, of his own money, on constituents. And, you know, we only have to start to ask questions in terms of the source of that wealth. And that's really where the questions will start to become a bit more complex for him to answer. So I would say to him, you know, be careful what you ask for. Because if we're going to talk scrutiny, you know, as my colleague just now said, we need to talk scrutiny. And while there are certain concerns regarding expenditure of government resources, there's also questions that can be reasonably asked about an individual that spends a considerable amount of his personal unaccounted wealth on constituents. And that is a reasonable question to ask. Of course, people are happy to receive it. I mean, there's no question about it. And you talked in the speech about paying light bills and water bills and helping people with their education. That's wonderful. The question, however, always comes up, you know, how do you account for this expenditure? To the question of healthcare, I think it's what we need to be careful about, where he suggests that people are being deprived of healthcare because of where they live. Every Antiguan is entitled to the same level of healthcare at that standard. You only have to walk into the St. John's Hospital, and they are essentially, sorry, Mount St. John's, and they are entitled to healthcare there. The idea of having a health center in every constituency is not an unreasonable position, but certainly it's one that government could easily argue that there are several other communities in Antigua and Barbuda that don't have a healthcare facility either. I mean, Barbuda has a different issue, and certainly would need to have localized healthcare on the island. But outside of that, the proximity of a place like farm to town is such that it's difficult to argue that you have to have a health center in that area. If you don't, people are being deprived of healthcare because, you know, with a short trip into the city, they can call an ambulance, I believe. You know, they are entitled and they will get the same healthcare that people in other parts of Antigua will receive. Mm.
Dr. Hines,
if I may say, I think that's
a... Yeah, well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just want to say very quickly, I think that's a fair point about healthcare. The part where it becomes suspect is because Michael is saying the decisions are being made not on the basis of an efficient allocation of health resources, but specifically to bring about political change. That's where it crosses over from a legitimate rationing of healthcare services to a deeply troubling act, if what he is saying is true.
Dr. Hines, I'd invite you to comment on this issue of the parliamentary representation matter. I'd also ask you to comment on this issue of the big money spending, really and truly. And it really is no secret to the point that Mr. Michael speaks about it publicly. And I'm just going to quote a little bit from his speech here. He says, "I've been able to provide throughout the constituency, in the absence of government support, including but not limited to full scholarships to secondary school, college and university, primary and secondary school supplies, laptops, tablets and IT connectivity, financial assistance for medical attention locally and overseas, financial assistance for home construction and repair, sponsorship of sports teams and events, sponsorships of artists and musicians, cash grants for small business development, cash grants for the payments of utility bills, livelihood income support for the vulnerable, and annual care and goodwill packages for all households." Now that is an individual, that is a sitting MP stating quite frankly that he's spending millions of dollars, or has spent millions of dollars, in direct material and cash support to his constituents. So my question, Dr. Hines, is what effect does that have on the democratic process?
I think it goes to the heart of the practice of our democracy. It's governance by clientelism. And we have known that all along in the English-speaking Caribbean. But Mr. Michael has demonstrated it very, very clearly there for us. And I want to make this observation that Mr. Michael is spending his own money, But if we have been following the debate as we have been, and the exchanges between the Prime Minister and himself, in terms of the source of his personal wealth, and if the allegations that he benefited from government largesse, then in effect what he's doing is spending that government money back on his constituency in the form of his own money. But as I said, there have been allegations that he made his wealth partly from benefiting from government largesse. So I just wanted to slip that in. So
I will jump in just to remind our listeners that he has denied those allegations.
That is why I said
and it's always a point, he's never actually, to my knowledge, been put through the criminal process, you know, brought on charges or anything like that. So often his remarks are, when he defends himself, that, you know, this is political. It's never been, you know, the police have never hauled him up before a court and put through the process. He usually points to that to demonstrate his innocence.
Well, that's right. And in any case, the cabinet, as in the case with the land sale, the cabinet agreed to his request for relief.
Concession.
Yes. The second point I want to make, look, he's challenging the whole business of our adapted Westminster. Westminster, in its strict theoretical sense, is based on legislative supremacy. That is the Westminster system that we have gotten from Britain. But in practice, we have had what I have called in other places, executive tyranny. So within the context of this theoretical legislative supremacy, assumed legislative supremacy, we have had executive tyranny. I think he has zeroed in on that, and he's subtly making the case for legislative supremacy, which, as I said, in theory, is the basis of Westminster. So there is that comes over in his presentation. And the third observation I would like to make is the role of the political party. He's challenging the practice of the political party. You know, we've talked about executive tyranny, but the political party is paramount in a sense to the government, because the political party forms the government, and through the process of clientelism, the political party in a sense operates as paramount to the government. Guyana in 1974, the Prime Minister of Burnham then declared that the party was paramount to the government and the state. And I would argue that he was brave enough to do that, but in practice in the rest of the Caribbean, the party is paramount. And Asaph Michael is now challenging that. He's asking whether, in fact, the party should have the power to determine who should be the representative in a constituency. And so he's taking us to places in our scrutiny of our political process that we have never spent the time that we need to teasing out those questions. Political scientists may listen to a speech like that and see it in profound terms. I don't think Asaph Michael sets out to be profound. I think he sets out to build his case for an independent candidacy. But in the process of doing so, he is raising some serious questions about political praxis in the Caribbean, the English-speaking Caribbean.
Mr. Maharaj, we have this ongoing discussion. Well, I don't know if I should call it an ongoing discussion, but the issue of how candidates spend money, campaign finance, is something we have laws on. We do have laws on it, and we do have laws that in the various amendments of the Representation of the People Act that list and state what is right and what is wrong. We also have reporting periods in terms of the funding of elections and so on and so forth. But I've always been really interested in the issue of what candidates spend outside of the election period. Like, it's nowhere near an election and a candidate is simply being a philanthropist in their area. So let's say that, you know, I'm running in, I don't know, Barbuda, and I'm a wealthy person. There's no election nearby. And I spend a lot of money out of my own pocket in delivering material and financial support to people who I would like to elect me. And I seem to escape the scrutiny of anyone in doing that, because it doesn't seem that it is considered campaign spending. It's just my philanthropy. And there's, you know, I'm in the middle of the year. There's no election. When I say the middle of the year, maybe the middle of a term. I say there's no election due soon. Election hasn't been called. Is that an anomaly that you think we need to fix? Because, I mean, it goes on throughout the Caribbean, the amount of money that candidates personally spend on their constituents.
You've raised a number of important issues. Let me start with the last one. Is it an anomaly? Unfortunately, it's not an anomaly. All countries, all democracies tend to define an electoral period. In some cases, it's quite narrow. In some cases, it's quite broad. But in all democracies, there's a period where there's heightened scrutiny. But that does not mean there should be no scrutiny outside of the electoral period. I think the challenge in Antigua and Barbuda is that, once again, both the laws and the institutions are very weak. The Antigua and Barbuda Electoral Commission itself has only existed since about 2001. And I think it's important to bear in mind that it only came into existence because of pressure from the Commonwealth Observer Group. In other words, had an international institution not raised this issue in an international forum, it's likely that there would be no independent electoral commission. In addition, although the Representation of the People's Act does prohibit certain kinds of actions like bribery, the commission itself, on its website and in its materials, says nothing about enforcing those laws. It's clear that the Electoral Commission sees its role as running elections, that is to say, registering voters and ensuring the voting process goes smoothly. They seem to have no interest in actually overseeing questions like the integrity of the conduct of candidates and ensuring that candidates, even during the electoral process, abide by legal requirements around how they spend their money. The broader question that you raised, though, about individual politicians using their funds between elections to cultivate and develop a kind of client-patron relationship with their constituents, that is, again, very serious. It's completely, there seems to be no oversight and no legislative control over it whatsoever. If Mr. Asset Michael's speech is any indicator, politicians in Antigua and Barbuda boast about the extent to which they hold their constituents captive by doling out money. They are not ashamed of it. They see it as a badge of honor. It is, in fact, a badge of dishonor because it is tantamount to buying votes. What's more, we have to ask ourselves, where does all this money come from? Because a politician who believes that his hold on power is dependent on his ability to ladle out cash in his constituency is a politician who's very likely to obtain some of that cash through illicit means and through the abuse of his access to government resources. All of this is just rotten. It's just rotten. And the fight between Mr. Michael and his one-time colleagues in Parliament is like watching a group of pigs hurling mud at one another, none of whom seems to be conscious of the fact that they are all rolling around in the mire.
Mr. Peter Wickham, I want to get your take on this issue of the money spending. And I'll leave it as an open question. What do you think of it? The fact that we have, and it's all throughout the Caribbean, we have certain individuals. I mean, everybody tries to spend as much money as they can, but we do have certain individuals who are more endowed than others who just spend. I mean, they just spend. You know, what effect do you think that has? Is that fair?
No, I mean, and Akash's presentation is compelling. I mean, the reality of the situation is that it's a mess. It's a political mess, but it's not a mess that's confined to Barbados. Sorry, to Antigua and Barbuda. It's a mess that is across the region. Generally speaking, people think that Asa Michael is a good member of parliament. Asa Michael won one of the highest majorities in the last election simply because he spends considerable amounts of money, of his own money and his resources, and he has them on people in this constituency. And people will always tell you, you know, he's a good person because if I have a medical bill to pay, he will pay. The challenge we have in the Caribbean is that your ability to represent people in any of the OECS territories, Barbados, I think Jamaica and Trinidad are somewhat different because they're larger and we can talk about them separately. But the reality that we have is that government is not in a position to provide short-term financial assistance, you know, to assist people with things like medical bills and school shoes or whatnot. Government is not able to do that. And the members of parliament in all of the islands, they step in and do that. And I mean, the members complain bitterly that unless you have considerable personal resources, you can't deal with the challenges. And I mean, we could say that, you know, it's offensive, the level of spending and whatnot, but I also see the other side. And I hear that, you know, when someone falls and needs to fly overseas to receive medical treatment in Dominica or St. Vincent, where there's no such CAT-SCAN facility available, and they have to get to Barbados, you know, who pays for it?
Well, if I could jump in, Peter.
Has to dig into their pocket and do that.
If I could jump in. I wonder what you think of this, because I think the issue may be the marriage of the politics and the philanthropy. I mean, nobody has a problem with a philanthropist. If a philanthropist wants to assist you to pay your light bills or to send you away for medical treatment, that's fine. The problem is when that philanthropist is also supposed to be fairly in a competition with other persons seeking elected office, and the issue of them spending this money becomes competitively a massive issue of unfairness and polluting what should be a fair race, what should be a fair opportunity for constituents to consider, you know, the policies and objectives and parliamentary representation of the persons they elect, when in fact they're actually considering, you know, the personal relationship they have with the person based on, you know, what assistance they've been able to get. I mean,
yeah, but Kieran, I understand that, but my question is, what is fair, right? If you have to ask the average Antiguan to say to you, what do you want in a member of parliament? They're going to give you certain ideas about what they want. And I think that that's the quintessential definition of fairness, right? I think what's fair for me is very different because I have different needs and expectations in terms of my own member of parliament. But there are people in my constituency, in the same way that there are people in Antigua, that have different expectations. And I think that Antigua's political system over time, and I've been in on the ground for several elections, has developed into one where there are expectations that there will be personal rewards that people will receive. And that's the reality that we have to live with. I would love for us to clean it up. And I think that in Antigua, you guys have done more than most of the islands, because at least you have some semblance of election regulations for spending during the course of an election. That's absent in all of the other islands. But I agree that there is a gulf regarding how MPs spend money outside of that period. What I would say is that we can do it. The challenge is that we have to come up with a novel idea of doing it. But we also have to understand it's going to cost the state considerable money, because where there's no asset, Michael, the state has to be in a position to provide that needed assistance to individuals. You have to have a mechanism to do it. You have to have a mechanism to distribute it. And you also have a mechanism to monitor the spending, which means that you are looking and saying to the state, well, look, if you're going to prevent MPs from doing it, you have to be in a position to step up and provide that level of assistance themselves. You know, one of the major reasons why women are not preferred as candidates in most of the OECS territories, and I've done a survey on it, is because people say that, generally speaking, men are more like us and Michael, are more likely to be like him. Well, the women come with this form and say, you know, we go to the welfare office and we get an established grant that will go on over time or whatnot. Well, the men will dip their hands in their pocket and say, look, hold some money and go and take care of yourself. And this is a reality. And I'm not saying that, I'm not trying to present it as the ideal. I'm saying that when we have these conversations, we have to look at the reality of a person who is on the ground, who may very well not have the benefit of an education and various access, and may have short-term needs. The members of parliament fulfill them, and it's a secret ballot, so they don't have to vote for them. But invariably people say, I'm going to vote for the person that treats me well. So we can talk about fairness. Who defines fairness? Fairness is defined by voters as wanting a member of parliament that can give them assistance where and when necessary. That's what, in many instances, they get. If the members of parliament can rely heavily on government's resources, then they can get from government resources. In instances where they don't, they probably will find it easier to just pay the bills themselves.
Dr. Hines, what do you think?
I think it's the very question of the nature of constituency politics. Those who argue for constituency politics make the point that know who their representative is. And theoretically, the representative is supposed to represent the constituents in parliament. But I agree that representation for us in the Caribbean really means what the member of parliament can do for individuals and families in the constituency. And I have to say that that is almost universal, even in the United States. It's accepted that the representative is supposed to bring back some pork to the constituency, right? And they do that in...
But the question is where you get the pork from, if it's government pork or if it's pork you pull out your pants.
But you're right. But again, I agree with Peter that, raising an ethical question, one must ask the question, are ethics and morality still part of our political process? So I, the very nature of constituency politics, you take a place like Guyana, there's no constituency. So there is not that problem in Guyana. Where the clientism operates in Guyana, which is a PR system and have constituency, the party comes constituency. So resources are steered from the government to the party, and the party then becomes the client, as opposed to the individual representative. So this problem in a society like ours, what is representation? That is the fundamental question here. What do we understand representation to mean? And if representation means that we have to give resources to mostly impoverished communities, then the ethics about where those resources come from become secondary, as is the case with our practice in the Caribbean.
Mr. Maharaj, towards the end of this segment, what final word would you want to leave us with? And then I'll jump back to Peter for his final word as well.
I confess, I did not think we would be discussing pigs and pork quite so much during this panel, but here we are. To begin with, I think one of the key differences between bribery and philanthropy is whether you expect something in return. Mr. Michael has been clear that one of the reasons the reason that he poured all of this money into his constituency was because he is, as he put it, a loyal party man. He's not putting this money into the constituency by his own admission out of the goodness of his heart. He's doing so in the expectation of a political return for himself and his party. That's not philanthropy. And it's clear that if he loses his seat at the next election, he is going to turn off the taps. But the other question is, where is this money coming from? Philanthropy is when I give you my money. Corruption is when I steal your money from you and give you a couple of pennies back for every dollar that I take. Mr. Michael has not been charged or convicted of a crime, but one cannot ignore the fact that when he was arrested in the United Kingdom by British police, he was arrested in connection with accusations of a bribery scandal involving Peter Verdi in Antigua and Barbuda. If the money that politicians spend in their constituency are money that they obtain through political corruption, then the people are net worse off. They may think that they are getting something from their representatives, but all they are getting are some of the crumbs and the residue of the vast amount of money that is being taken away from them by corruption. I would agree with Peter's assessment that in the end, whether this is right or wrong is a question for the people of Antigua and Barbuda to decide. What are their values? What are their political norms? Do they want to have parliamentarians and a parliament that speaks to the public good and the national interest? Or are they expecting nothing more than the ability to sell their vote and their constituency to the highest bidder, the person who will bring back the most pork? Obviously, I hope that the people of Antigua and Barbuda will decide that they want to create a political structure that will enrich not just them, but future generations, rather than live in a kind of semi-feudal system where every 4 years they get to choose a robber baron who will decide how much he's going to steal from them and in exchange how little he can bribe them with. And finally, I would also say that Peter and David make an important point that if Antigua and Barbuda and other countries in across the world are to replace a system of clientelism with a system of democratic governance, then the state has to play a role in providing for the people. One of the reasons that people expect MPs to provide for them is that the state is not doing so. In the case of Antigua and Barbuda, the state is capable of providing for the people. Mr. Michael's speech was in response to the budget speech, and the Prime Minister in the budget speech himself was very clear that, and indeed boasted, that Antigua and Barbuda has the lowest tax to GDP ratio in the OECS subregion. That means that rich people in Antigua and Barbuda pay no taxes. The country is rich, but the people are poor, because the state will not tax the rich to enable the state to democratically support the poor, instead leaving the provision of basic public services in the hands of individual politicians instead of in the hands of democratic institutions. And that creates a situation where a state has all the cosmetic appearances of a democracy, but is little more than a way of every 4 years or so choosing a new ruling class. I think the people of Antigua and Barbuda deserve better than that, but it's up to the people of Antigua and Barbuda to decide whether they believe they deserve better than that.
Mr. Wickham, your final statement very quickly.
I'm anxious to respond. Well, I'm tempted to respond and basically say that, you know, the people of Antigua have decided in their own interest that they want to vote for a no tax environment. And that's consistent with what the ABLP was elected on. It's not for me to decide that that's how it should go. That's a different conversation. And the fact that, you know, they have continued to vote for a no tax environment, that's a personal preference and a personal right of individuals. But if Asa Michael wants to talk reform of the system, I'm with him. I'm not convinced that that's what he wants to do, but I've made a note on a couple of things he needs to be willing to discuss. One of them is national MPs. Your system in Antigua with the constituency MPs, in some of the other islands, small islands, we have national MPs emerging, and normally those are harder to buy, one could say. And I think that could be a kind of a constitutional recommendation where you augment your system with national MPs to create a balance between the local ones and so on. Integrity legislation, and then of course the idea of having a commissioner for your tenders committee to see if you could get some balance there. So those are some of the ideas that we can start to think about if it is that Asa Michael is anxious to look at a reform of the system.
And with that, we can end this segment here. I want to say thank you to all three guests, Mr. Peter Wickham, Director of the Caribbean Development Research Services, that's the polling and research firm Cadres. We say thank you as well to Dr. David Hines, political commentator from Guyana and Associate Professor of African and African American Studies at the Arizona State University. And finally, of course, to Mr. Akash Maharaj, an ambassador at large with the Global Organization of Parliamentarians Against Corruption, known as GOPAC. Thanks to all three of you for joining us this afternoon.